The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning, everyone. And so one of the things on my mind this morning, I'd like to summarize with the idea that, well-known idea that there's a difference between our reactions and our responses. And the thing I'd like to add to this idea is that in probably if you under, you know, my one take of Buddhist teachings is that it's more useful to identify or focus on your responses than it is on your reactions. Reactions are important, but if we want to be somebody, we be our responses, not how we happen to react. And so I say that as an introduction to saying some words about the shooting in Aurora, Colorado, because I couldn't really think about saying anything else talking but that. But also, besides what I just said, I'm kind of not sure what to say. I don't know if anybody knows what to say. At least some of the people who are saying things, I wish they wouldn't. So maybe I shouldn't. It's kind of stunning, stunned. Many people are stunned by such a thing. And it's, I think it's interesting to reflect, why it's more stunning to read something where it's concentrated, so many people get wounded and shot. Because probably in any given day in the United States, as many people get shot and wounded. But it just spread out, and more people do it. But something about that kind of event, and in a movie theater, I mean, people are not only kind of somewhat defenseless in movie theater, but they're a little bit in an altered state, and it's kind of a bizarre kind of or frightening situation to be in, and it kind of touches on kind of a nerve, I think, in our society. Movie theaters are kind of special, considered safe places to go usually, and I imagine there's a lot of people now who are going to go to movie reluctant to go to movie theaters or will feel a little bit frightened. Can you have trouble hearing, some of you? Yeah, just a little bit louder, please. So, is that a little bit better? So, so one of the nice things I think I've seen come out of this is a number of nice things in the responses people have had, but one of them is the call for a vigil. Vigils, and, moments of silence and things like that. And I think there's something very wise about this idea of stopping. And in that, this is kind of one of the key things about, I think Buddhism emphasizes the idea of stopping for a while and not reacting, instinctively. But in that stopping, in the pause, some people talk about a sacred pause or, important pause, where many things can happen in that pause, and it gives a chance for things to happen that couldn't happen if we react to situations like this or other situations. And one of the things that we can do in a pause is we could spend time being mindful, take in what's going on here, take it in more deeply, and not just take it in terms of, letting it register in our emotional body, but to turn towards these things if they have a big impact on us and try to understand or what's going on or kind of investigate more deeply. Maybe we don't understand exactly why something like that happened, not yet, but there's a variety of, there's more information to be had about the event. And already, there's people in the press, for example, who have rushed to make statements that later they have to apologize for because, they didn't pause long enough to kind of get all the information. And so this idea of pausing and stopping. And it's, in terms of mass murder, there's one of the fairy tales, probably a fairy tale, maybe not part of it, that goes back to the time of the Buddha, is a story of a mass murder in Angulimala, who the Buddha went to confront in the woods, in the forest where he lived. And so the Buddha was walking through the trail down the path in the forest, and Angulimala saw him and thought, oh great, another victim, I can't wait. And so set off after the Buddha. And then the Buddha calmly kept walking down the path, and Angulimala started running after him. And the more he was running, the less he could catch up to the Buddha, who was walking calmly. So finally, Angulimala called out to the Buddha and said, stop. And the Buddha said to him, Angulimala, I have already stopped. Why don't you stop? So, you know, it wasn't meant to be taken literally, the statement. It was the Buddha, you know, was reinterpreting, like the Buddha often did, reinterpret what people are saying. And so he was reinterpreting and saying, when Angulimala was saying stop, literally stop, you know, stop walking, the Buddha interpreted as being your tendency towards violence, your busy mind, your active mind, your crazy mind doesn't stop. And I've stopped mine. Why don't you stop? And so that statement got Angulimala's attention. And so then he was willing to listen to the Buddha and eventually became a disciple of the Buddha and developed quite high level of spiritual attainment. So I don't know about, you know, the fairy tale, but this idea of stopping, you know, is kind of epitomized in this famous Buddhist story. What does it mean to stop? What are we stopping? And what can we stop internally that's useful to stop? And I think for many people, it's to stop their automatic reactivity. Some of our activity maybe is wise, but some of it maybe isn't so wise. And do we even have the ability to stop? Do we have the ability to not get caught in our reactivity, in our views, our opinions, our feelings? And this, I think, is really a crucial and important issue in anybody, including the whole nation, responding to any kind of tragedy or violence, is for us to be very mindful and careful about what our reactions are and responses. In the Buddhist scene, like ours, in mindfulness practice, the idea is to stop for our reactions and be very respectful of them. Respectful doesn't mean that we condone them, every single one of them, and, you know, say, great. But rather, to respect them is to have some confidence or some willingness or some belief that it's useful to go in and be present for what's going on inside of us. That what's going on inside of us maybe shouldn't be seen as a mistake or a problem, but rather something to touch, be informed, learn about, work through, process, dissolve, resolve, be a vehicle, a doorway into touching something deeper inside of ourselves. And you can't do that if you dismiss it. You can't do it if you ignore what our reactions are, our emotions are. You can't do it if you act on them too quickly. If anything, acting them on unhealthy emotions can just make them stronger. So this ability to stop and turn and look is extremely important. And it's hopefully something that protects ourselves and protects others. This is one of the teachings of Buddhism, that the practice of mindfulness is a practice that protects others, I suppose from yourself. And if we can cultivate a, you know, society of people have the ability to be mindful, then it becomes a protection for all of us. But also to stop and take in what's really going on in a fuller way around us. Sometimes it's too painful to do that. We have to kind of monitor ourselves and know what we can take in. But I find it really informative, very interesting to kind of read the news and all the different opinions, but also to read what happened there in Aurora. I felt like it's important in a situation like this because it's such a big scar in the psyche of the nation, and because the nature of it is so powerful, to linger with it, stay with it. And so I read the names of all the victims and read something about them, and it's kind of touching to read about them and read about the people who threw their own bodies on top of others. They died, but they saved the others in the meeting of it. Or a six-year-old child who's sitting there watching it, the movie, and then gets shot. But then, you know, it's then the event itself, you know, the movie, and what's that about? My 14-year-old son loves this, the Dark Knight movie. I guess he saw one and two, And he saw it too many times. And so eventually he got me to see it with him. And just the movie itself made me uncomfortable. And in the amount of violence and the amount of horror and the amount of kind of demented mentality and relationship to people that the movie depicts, I did not enjoy watching. It was actually quite disturbing. I wouldn't say it's as disturbing as reading the news or about Aurora, but it was quite disturbing that someone would make a kind of movie like this and present it. But, you know, maybe I'm an odd guy, right? And there seems to be a lot of people who not only enjoy it and rush to it, the opening, but they bring their six-year-old child to it. You know, it's kind of unbelievable to me that that's what you'd bring a child to. But, you know, I'm an odd guy, you know, so what's that about? About me, sure, what's that about me? But what about, you know, what does it say about, you know, I don't want to rush to saying what does it say about, but I think it's useful to kind of be mindful of this and to just kind of look more carefully and take it in and try very hard not to judge it. I think it's really important not to rush to judgment, because one of the things I see is when people rush to judgments on all spectrums, all sides of whatever judgments they have, it increases divisiveness in our society. And the idea of divisiveness in our society, there's so many people in our society who seem irreconcilable in their views, and very powerful views. So, I mean, there's already discussion about gun control, right? And people are rushing into the idea of that. But it seems like it's hopeless in this country to kind of take positions around gun control. Maybe it's possible to do something, but it seems like there are parties that are irreconcilable about these different sides of gun control. So to take positions and quickly judge, you know, this is what should happen, one way or the other, maybe there's no meeting ground, there's no commonality. It increases divisiveness in our society. And is this a time for divisiveness, or is this a time to somehow come together or see each other as a in our family as a whole? One of the comments I've heard from people is, you know, there are people who are shocked, can't believe that these things happen. How could this happen? You know, things must be getting worse. But when I read the news, I was horrified by it, stunned by it, but I wasn't surprised by it. And, to me, the idea that these kinds of things happen is built into the kind of nature of what our society and people are about. In being a Buddhist teacher, I've tried to dedicate myself to make a difference and improve these things and not to make these part of our life. But I kind of expect them, you know. And, you know, in some ways I feel very blessed that most of my adult life has lived in peace and peaceful situations. And I think it's relatively peaceful. My parents' generation, with my parents and who grew up in Europe, and my parents-in-law who grew up in Europe, they grew up through World War II. And, you know, and I tried to imagine what they went through. Many of the people I knew spent time in a variety of prison camps during World War II. What was it like, you know, to grow up in that kind of environment, and the war and the violence and the devastation that people I know saw at that time, you know, day after day, year after year. So I feel pretty blessed. And then we say it must be getting worse. But, you know, and then the Buddha, there was a mass murderer, right, at his time. There's a story of, that's all, again, I don't know if it's a fairy tale or whether it's happened, but I can imagine this one more likely than the mass murderer story of the Buddha started to get popular in the local parts of India where he was at, and there were other religious sects, and some of them were jealous of the Buddha getting popular. And so they asked one of their nuns in that particular sect of religion, they asked her, oh, go visit the Buddha and hear what he has to teach, and go regularly and hang out there for a while. So she would go and hang out there. And then, so people got to see this woman was hanging out around the Buddha. And then they murdered her and put her body kind of in the Buddha's camp, you know, where he was living. so that she'd be found there, the corpse would be found there. And then they would spread this rumor, look what happens, you know, it's the Buddha. Buddha must have killed her. So the Buddha had to deal with this, you know, the false charges and what to do about this. And so, it's not a pretty story. The time of the Buddha, you know, my vision of the Buddha when I was kind of growing up in Buddhism was kind of this guy who was kind of serene, Mr. Natural, you know, living peacefully and living in the forest under a nice tree, and you know, there was never any thunder or lightning around him, you know, and storms, and you know, he just kind of managed everything beautifully. But as I read more deeply into the history and the suttas of the Buddha's time, it was a time of tremendous strife and war and fighting and kings, you know, countries, you know, conquering each other. And it wasn't just simply that he was, like, you know, staying in the forest watching from a distance, but these involved people that he knew. He knew some of the, he knew the kings, he knew the people. He was very closely connected to many people who were influenced by affected by all this. So I say this because, you know, here we are having, you know, we live in our situation. And I think sometimes I suspect that the peace that some of us experience, like me, you know, I haven't been in the middle of war at any time in my life, perhaps creates a false impression or kind of a too quick ability to forget or to overlook these things. How many of you remember there was a similar shooting just a few months ago in Oakland? Or last year there was a similar shooting down in Sunnyvale, it was, at the cement factory. And a year ago now there was a shooting in Norway. So, you know, these things go on and on. So these are part of our life. And how do we take it in? And how are we informed by it? How do we take it in? How do we stop and take it in so that we become better people for it? I think that's one of the key, really important issues, you know, that's why this thing of how do we respond? And as some people have said, and I feel this is a really wise approach, is when someone dies, especially if they're murdered or like this, it's a tragedy. But what's the consequence of their death? Is the consequence of their death that now people are living lives of greater fear, greater anger, greater hate, greater divisiveness? Is that the consequence? I mean, if you were murdered, would you like to know later that this is the consequence of your dying, that the society is a world is a worse place? Or is the consequence of someone dying that people are motivated to try to be better people, to make a world a better place, to be inspired to respond to the world more with love and compassion and generosity than they were before? And sometimes people protest this kind of idea because it seems like the only thing that's only what's justified, the only thing that honors in someone's death is if there is punishment and anger and strong things, and it's almost condoning the violence if the consequence is we're more loving or caring or something. But I hope that these kinds of things we can kind of, I'm certainly hoping to stop these kinds of things, will never happen again. But when they happen, that they prompt us to really, for the best of us, to come forward and out of it, and not the divisive one. So here's an interesting story or event that I want to recount to you that talks about an event that was pretty similar here in the United States about 40 years ago, 1963. There was a shooting in the University of Texas. Some man went up the tower with a gun and shot something like 12, 13 people in down from the shot to the tower. And in 1966, a man named Charles Whitman, 25-year-old, the first woman he shot was pregnant. The others ran to help her. He shot them as well. He shot the ambulance drivers who came to rescue them. Eventually, the police were able to climb the tower and shoot him. And they found a suicide note at his home. And he wrote, "I do not really understand myself these days. I was supposed to be an average, responsible, and intelligent young man. However, lately, I cannot recall when it started, I have been a victim of many unusual and irrational thoughts." So anyway, he shot these people, and eventually the police shot him. They went to his home or somewhere, and he found out that he'd also murdered his mother and his wife beforehand. Then his note, suicide note, says, "It was after much thought that I decided to kill my wife tonight. I love her dearly, and she's been a fine wife to me as any man could ever hope to have. I cannot rationally pinpoint any specific reason for doing this." He had a high IQ. He was in, volunteered as a scoutmaster. He was a good person, conventionally from the outside. He wrote in a suicide note, he requested in a suicide note that an autopsy to be performed to determine if something had changed in his brain, because he suspected it had. A few months before the shooting, he wrote in his diary, "I talked to a doctor once for about 2 hours and tried to convey to him my fears that I felt overcome by overwhelming violent impulses. After one session, I never saw the doctor again, and since then I have been fighting my mental turmoil alone, and seemingly to no avail." So they did an autopsy on him after he was killed. And what they found was he had a tumor in his brain. And the tumor was pushing against the amygdala. And apparently they've known for a long, long time that when the amygdala is being damaged, that people have irrational tendencies, strong emotional responses and reactions that can be quite difficult. The amygdala is involved in emotional regulation, especially in regards fear and aggression. So does that paint a different perspective on, certainly the guy in 1966? Do we relate to it differently, knowing that he has a tumor, than if he's just out for a good time? This book that I'm having to read, he argues, the chapter is called something like, "Why Blameworthiness is the Wrong Question." Why asking who's to blame is the wrong question. And what he ends the chapter by saying is, rather than asking who's to blame, it's probably more useful to ask the question, how do we respond to this? How do we look into the future and try to, have the best response for everyone involved? And the question of blame sometimes closes the door too tightly to try to understand, how can we do better? How can we change? What kind of help is needed? So, if it's just blame, let's electrocute this person and be finished with it. Then as a society, do we not learn about mental illness? And if we don't learn about mental illness, then perhaps there's no effort to try to do something about mental illness. And it's been kind of amazing to me in the profession that I'm in, where I meet a lot of people and talk about people. And people's minds are kind of like one of my concerns, right? And so I hear a lot and see a lot, and it just it's one of the shocks to me, one of the great tragedies, is how little help our society now gives to people who have mental illness. And it's not just simply a problem for the person who has mental illness, but it's also a problem for the people who are affected by the mental illness. The problems ripple out in all kinds of ways, and maybe we can't afford it, and so that's the way it is. Or is that all it is? And so this issue of this guy in 1966 with a tumor, Do we then look upon these situations? Do we mindful in a different way? Do we mindful of the situation in a different way? Do we look in different ways? Do we look at we look at these kinds of tragedies in ways that just close the door? Blame, or there's all kinds of ways that close the door on all sides of this political spectrum or emotional spectrum. How do we stay open? How do we stay open and explore? And what values do we try to emphasize? Are the values that are not divisive, but rather bring people together and find common ground? I would hope, maybe gun control, you can't find common ground enough to make us change in this country, but could we find common ground, the different sides of that political divide, around trying to find a better mental care or medical care? This guy here in 66, he went to the doctor, right? He tried to find help. But maybe there wasn't much known back then. So each of you, I suppose, who impacted in some way by this. Oh, this is another thing that, if I may say, I meet a lot of people, and because there's a lot of people come here, and I meet a lot of people in different situations. It's happened so many times now that I read something in the newspaper, and then sometime later, someone comes to me or talk to me who's been touched by that event. It's kind of how many steps away? How was it 9 degrees of difference or whatever it is? Or I don't know. I forget what it's called. Six degree of separation. So the people in my role, it seems like be a lot less. So now sometimes I look at newspapers and I look more. I read the articles more carefully because maybe I need to remember this. Someone's going to come. So here we are, and. So each of you maybe has been affected in some way, maybe personally, maybe not so directly, but still by reading it or seeing in the news. And do you stop? Do you have your vigil? Do you stop and allow yourself and respect how you're feeling? Make room for how you're feeling, the whole range of it, what it is. Because to live a life, a world where we don't divide up the world in a divisive way, we don't want to do that with ourselves either, be divisive with ourselves. And feel like your response somehow is wrong or bad or whatever way you judge it, but make space for it. That's with mindfulness. Make space, open up, become whole. And then once we see how we react to it, then there's a more intentional part where we choose what are the values that we want to live by, what are our responses to it. And one of the significant things about Buddhist practice is that as we practice and cultivate, free ourselves, develop ourselves in practice, the goal is that to bring the difference between our reaction and our response, make it smaller and smaller, so that eventually the way that we want to respond to the world with wisdom and care and compassion, that also becomes our reaction. The two don't become so separate from each other. And that's part of the practice, is to narrow that divide within ourselves between reaction and response. And I think that it's quite wonderful. Those people who have a practice, some kind of practice, many practices, not just Buddhist practices, but have a practice that is trying to cultivate themselves, develop themselves, so the most important and beautiful sides of the human heart, the human mind, has a chance to flower and grow within us. So those are, that's what came out of me. I tried to give some thought to this talk. Before coming, I thought it was important to say something. I felt it was somehow felt it was really important. If I was going to speak about this, say something important, or valuable, or useful, or something. But I also didn't know what to say, and so I felt kind of torn. So I spoke these words. I hope they're meaningful for you. We have a few minutes. If some of you would like to say something, you're welcome to speak to me. It's been a few minutes with your response or comments.
Is it on? Okay. In hearing you talk about how you were reading the paper about the different stories, my reaction, I don't read the stories and I don't watch. Like there were specials all of a sudden on TV about what happened in Aurora, and I don't watch them or read them because I feel very often that it's offered as entertainment. People's suffering is being offered as entertainment and a way to get the numbers up for purchased papers or the Nielsen ratings and stuff like that. But you were talking about reading the stories, and I wonder if I'm making a mistake in not reading the stories, because my reason thus far for not reading the stories, I can get stuck in the stories. Instead of what I did last night was I set aside some time to do kind of like a metta for all the people that are suffering from this, not just the dead, but you know, the people, all the people that were in the theater, then the town of Aurora, then the state of Denver, I mean the state of Colorado, like that. And then and I don't know if that's if I'm doing the wrong kind of response because I'm not reading the stories. I'm not getting involved in, I don't know.
This sensationalistic aspect of journalism is a very important one to take into account. And so to be wise about that and to not be pulled into that, I think, is a useful thing. And I don't watch television. I don't have a television to watch. And, you know, I don't watch it. But I think it's other ways of learning, maybe even, newspaper writing, sometimes sensationalistic. But, hopefully we have the wisdom to see through that. And that's why this pause, sometimes the pauses need to be a long time, because maybe in the first days you get a certain kind of article and then it fades away and you get some more thoughtful reactions later. And so you want to take your time and take it in and not get hooked by what you read automatically. But, you know, some things don't really involve in story. So like many people, you know, how suffering like this ripples out into the wider society. You know, my heart kind of broke, you know, when I took in, those people. And one of the times it broke was when, I don't know if, you know, maybe it was sensationalistic, but there was a quote, I guess ABC called up this alleged shooter's mother, and they were quoting the mother before, you know, we heard what she had to say. And just to be reminded there's a mother of this guy, and, you know, what a tragedy for her! You know, she must have, you know, kind of my heart broke there for her, thinking about that. So I think it's possible to read wisely. Doing metta for everyone, I think, is a wise thing. It's possible to do metta, do loving kindness meditation in a situation like this. It's possible to do it as a way to hold it all at a distance, or to sugarcoat it, or do something. But it's also possible to do it as a tremendous form of generosity and a clear kind of taking in, understanding what the situation is, and offering something that hopefully, can change the overall direction that our wider society is going. So right behind you.
I have two things to say. The first is that in terms of the mental of Charles Whitman, and seeking help, it's become increasingly more difficult year after year.
To get help.
To force people,
yes,
to take medication,
yes,
to come back for therapy, to detain them. I mean, you can imagine what it was like for that psychiatrist to have that disturbed young man come into his office, and then the law, I don't know what the law is in Texas, in California, it's very difficult to detain someone who may really need to be contained until they can be treated. But my major point is to not forget about the first responders.
Oh, yeah.
Who have to go into a scene like that. They don't know where the shooter is. They don't know what the level of danger is. They are there with viewing the tragic, the grotesque. Some of you know I do retreats with first responders, and I just came back from one on Friday. And the general public simply doesn't understand what these people have to see. I mean, the stories are totally unrepeatable.
Yeah.
They are in some ways so grotesque and so tragic. And they got to get back up and go back to work again. And they have to stay in control of themselves and their emotions and try to help other people.
Yeah.
So while we're thinking of everybody, I would ask you all, please, not to forget the first responders.
Yeah. I felt for them when I read the police chief in Aurora, police chief Oates, talked you know, to the reporters about his anger, and it made sense. It makes, you know, I don't know. Maybe it's possible to have other responses than anger, but I said, of course, my heart broke there, and of course, you know, of course he would have such strong feelings, you know, and hopefully he holds anger wisely. But so one more in the outer room.
I guess my main thought about it, I watched one of those Dateline things last night, and the profile of the shooter, is like many others, he felt totally disenfranchised. He was completely alone. He had no friends. I don't know the story with his mother, but it makes me think that, you know, there's so many people out there who just feel alone, or, you know, they have mental illness and they feel depressed. That it's something that we need to reach out. We see people in our lives. Sometimes it's very unattractive, you know, somebody who's alone, but maybe we need to reach out more and make sure that people are okay, or we know people in our lives are not doing well with a mental health issue. Being proactive about reaching out to that person.
Yeah, maybe. So the idea that we're, you know, so one of the ideas that's important for me is that we're all in the boat together. And, you know, in some way, we're all each other's brothers and sisters. And so that point of view, you know, it's a point of view. I find that a meaningful point of view that I think will help create a better society. So how do we relate? Are there some people who are not, we don't see as our brothers and sisters, some people who we hold at a distance? And what's our role, you know, as citizens in relationship to the wider society? And what are the myths, what are the stories, beliefs that operate? So I'll give you one interesting one that was, I thought was kind of eye-opening for me many years ago. So, you know, back in the early 70s, I was a hippie and interested in living, and lived on communes, rural communes, where here in America, my ideal and the ideal of many of my hippie comrades was to be self-sufficient, to grow our own food and step off the kind of military-industrial complex was the expression back then, and not be part of it and grow your own food and just not add to the difficulties and problems of society. And so that's fine. So I'm originally from Norway, so in 1974 I went back to Norway, 1975 I think. And I was, you know, still a hippie living like commune. So I went to live in a commune, a rural commune in Norway. And I told them my American views about living in a commune, the philosophy behind it, about self-sufficiency. And the Norwegian hippies were horrified. Because the Norwegian worldview was, yes, you can live in a commune on a farm, but you don't do it, you don't separate yourself from society and be self-sufficient. You contribute to society. And so this idea, you know, so there's two different stories that we had back then. And so what stories do we live under? And do we live under stories that are divisive and separating, or do we live under stories that bring us together? And that's a choice we have. And to say which one is right or wrong is the wrong question, wrong issue. I think the question is which will help create a better society? And are you interested in a better society, or are you interested only in yourself? And if you're interested in a better society, what's the view, what's the approach that brings us together? So, and my hope is that, and my belief is that practice like mindfulness, inevitably, as the practice develops in people, it brings us together, because it's not possible to remain divisive when the heart is open. So may all of us keep our hearts open. Thank you.